Matthew 7, if you've got it handy, please. I was educated this week, again, that we live in the United Kingdom, and of course there was a time when it wasn't a United Kingdom. This was the 16th century, and across the English-Scottish border were many raids back and forth, many brutal acts of terrorism, if you like, and Scotland's greatest ally was France. So Scotland and France ganged up against England, if you like. And my history lesson suggested that all that was changed more or less by the influence of one man, John Knox, a Christian, who they said in this thing I was listening to, was instrumental in turning Scotland away from Catholic France, away from Catholic Scotland, and turning back to a Protestant Scotland, with many being saved, obviously, but even if people weren't saved, they rejected the Catholicism of France, despite the strenuous and sadistic efforts of Mary, Queen of Scots, who said she feared the prayers of John Knox more than any army. Knox was stirred to challenge Catholicism because of a fellow, Cardinal Beaton of Edinburgh, the Roman Catholic cardinal, who was celibate, as all Roman Catholic priests are, and yet had fathered at least 14 children. And so Knox was keen not just to address the kind of superficial, which Erasmus was interested in. If you ever know anything about Erasmus, he cared about the decadence in Rome. Where he differed from Luther was that he looked for surface, superficial remedies, and Luther looked to the heart of the problem, as did Knox. Now, if you look at Matthew 7, we see that awful verse that, you know, many will come in that day, and they'll say, Lord, Lord, and Jesus will say, I never knew you. And we see that the key thing is fruit. Verse 17, every good tree bears good fruit. You pick it out, you pick out the tree by the fruit. You pick out the fruit by the tree. It's that simple. And he says there, therefore, verse 20, referring to Cardinal Beaton or anybody else, by their fruit you'll know them. It's that simple. By their fruit you shall know them. What is fruit? Here's my definition for tonight. The desire and determination to do the will of God. That's my narrow explanation I'm going with tonight. So the fruit of being born again, fruit of being saved, whatever, converted, whatever language you want to use, is a desire and a determination to do the will of God, to do what pleases God, to do what God says, if you like. Now, there was a guy, excellent preacher, incidentally, who disagreed with me from the pulpit on more than one occasion. He was preached in the pulpit, but I had preached there before, and he wasn't embarrassed to tell everybody, more or less, that I was wrong. And I was wrong on one word. We were friendly terms. There was no bad feeling between us. But he believed, because I had said that motivation was the key to sanctification. Sanctification, becoming holy, becoming like Jesus. I always used to say the problem was we lacked motivation. He would say that I was wrong. It was all about desire. And my argument still is, I don't think it is nitpicking. You can have the desire, like I said to my wife today, I went swimming yesterday with the kids, I am shapeless. She didn't disagree, because it's true. I know it, she knows it. Now I could have the desire, and I do have a desire, not to be shapeless tomorrow morning. I'd like to leap out of bed and look like one of those athletes. But I need more than desire, I need a determination to do something about it. And if I'm not motivated sufficiently, though I have the desire, nothing will change. Or to use another illustration, the exams have just come. How many kids were in tears having the results of GCSEs or A-levels or whatever they were? They had a desire. They wanted to do well. But they didn't do well, because the desire wasn't accompanied by determination to say, oh, I really want to do do well in those exams, I'd probably have to open the books and revise. They didn't have the determination. So spiritual fruit, I am asserting tonight, involves desire and determination. We sing on Christ, the solid rock I stand, all, don't we? All other ground is singing, all other ground. We hear this parable sometimes, you know, the parable, the wise man and the foolish man, and we sometimes think that the obedience is not the issue necessarily, that Christ is a rock, but it's clear in this story and in the Luke version that Jesus is saying it's those who hear and obey. Those who are determined to follow Jesus and they do what he says. You know, somebody said years ago, believing is doing the words of Jesus. That's what believing means. We can say, oh yeah, I'm trusting. But this fellow was in his definition was saying, yeah, believing is doing the words, doing what Jesus says. So if you want to know, here's Sylvia. Oh, she's nice. You know Sylvia? She's imaginary. Here's Sylvia. She's nice. She's been coming here for years. Do you want to know what Sylvia believes? Well, listen to what she says. It's important. But more important, watch your life. Watch her live. Because as James rightly said, faith without works is, what? Dead. Some of you know, when I left teaching in 1990, the lady who had my job actually from the department, she fought the other 9 or 10 people off and outsiders as well and got the job. She was a religious lady, very able. But she came up that last day when I was leaving and she said to me, for 2 years now, I've watched you. Every time there was a dirty joke, I've watched you. Anytime there was anybody gossiping, I've watched you. Anytime there was anybody blaspheming, or I've watched you. And I was frightened. I got to be honest, when she said it, I just said, why? To see if you were real, she said. And as soon as she said it, I thought, yeah, good for you. Why not? Is he real? Are you real? What does real mean? Well, they bring forth fruit. By their fruit. You know them. They know one thing today, a different thing tomorrow. They're real. You know that old mantra of 20 odd years ago, I'm sure it's still around, to become a Christian, you know, you just pray this prayer, and then to live as a Christian, you just read the Bible and you say your prayers and you tell your friends. It's not enough. It's not enough, because you can do all that and bring no fruit forth. Believing on Christ means living it out. I remember being in the very early days of my Christian life, being on a committee. I wasn't on there for long. And they were talking about evangelism. And whoever was speaking seemed to dominate, said that it's very important, and when we're evangelizing, when we bring people into church, they're talking about the South Wales Valleys, they were incidentally, it's very important that we use the Authorized Version. Well, I was struggling with the Authorized Version. It's a great version, but I was struggling to understand the words myself. And I felt for people in the valleys, like me. So I remember saying to him, that's great, you like it, that's great. But what about Joe Public, who lives in Cumbach, or Ogmovale, or Nantymoel, or something like that? You know, is he really, if he comes in, is he going to understand it? And this old guy who'd been dominating, I think, said, well, if he doesn't understand, he needs to be educated before he can come in. Well, is that so? You know, very simply here, Jesus fleshes out the meaning. Spiritual growth is not about a particular version. It's not about learning Greek or Hebrew. It's not about singing certain type of song or hymn. It's not about reciting and memorizing verses. It's not about attending certain conferences to have a zap, as people used to say. Oh, I've gone for my zap, I'll have a nap now for 12 months till I go back again. Well, that's not it either, is it? You know, John writes his gospel, and right at the end, or near the end, he says, these things are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that through believing or by believing, you might have life. Life. Fruit. You know, we've got some blackberries growing in the garden. I didn't plant them. That's why they're growing, because I didn't plant them, and they're producing fruit, and it's lovely. And there are other things that die. They don't show any flowers or anything. And it's, you know, even a thickie like me about gardening, you can tell the difference between something that's pretty useless and dead and something that's bringing forth fruit. Hear our Lord, and if there was a going to be punchy, I'd say in the story, two fellas, two foundations, two futures. Right? It's very simple. Two fellas, two foundations, two futures. Now you imagine the first century Kevin MacLeod. Do you know who Kevin MacLeod is? Grand Designs, okay? And there's Sid and there's Ray, and good old Kev visits them, and they both got identical designs. They've used the same architect, George Clark. Have you heard of him? There we are. They both used him. They got identical designs, but they're in very different parts of Wales, say. And Kevin MacLeod says, oh, great, I'll come back in 6 months, see how you're getting on. Well, off they go. They both start. But Sid, you know, he builds on sand. He can't be bothered to dig. Oh, he digs a bit, but not much. Ray takes ages, and it's expensive. He is digging down till he hits bedrock, solid rock. But of course, Sid's house is flying up in no time. No, he's on the, you know, the second story before the other fellas even put the foundations down, before Ray has put the foundations down. And of course, Kevin MacLeod comes back in 6 months, and amazingly, Sid is finished and he's in. Ray's is nearly finished, and they both look lovely. They both look the same. A friend of mine who's in glory now, I was a missionary in Thailand, and he said the Bangkok Shell Oil building used reinforced concrete, but they used bamboo in the cement to make it reinforced. And sadly, there were termites or something in the bamboo, so they ate all the bamboo. And so you had this massive, beautiful building within a few years was just going over. But of course, it looked great when they put it down. See, Ray has had to dig and dig till he hits rock. And it's tiring, exhausting. But Sid, you know, why didn't you dig? Is Sid just stupid? It's not a question of intellect. It's not that he's a bit wacky. It's not that he thinks sand is a better base than bedrock. What's Sid's problem? He's basically superficial. He's sloppy. He thinks, okay, that is probably doesn't matter that much. I remember when we first married, and a friend came and built a tiny little porch on the back of the house, and I was the labourer. You know, bad move, isn't it, really? And you know, all the foundations for this little porch had to be about 8 inches. I was pretty certain in some places I'd got a bit lazy and it was a lot less. And it wasn't a surprise that many years later, when we visited the house, they knocked it down, whoever bought it. Just looked at that and said, "Don't, that's coming down." Because the foundations were useless. But Sid probably thinks, well, hurricanes don't happen here. We'll be all right. It'll be okay. See, you know, 2 Corinthians 13, Paul says, examine yourselves. That's what I want you to do tonight. Examine yourself. Are you bringing forth fruit? Are you in Christ? Every time you take the bread and the wine, next Wednesday, God willing, we are commanded to examine ourselves, not to be flippant, not to be casual. But, oh, I've done this, taking bread and wine before. It's serious, because if we're casual, we're eating and drinking damnation. You know, I remember 25 years ago, something like that, I saw a Bible in the Christian bookshop, the Life Application Bible. I remember thinking, oh, a new version, you know? But all it was really was the old version with application, and I just thought, why do they need it? Because they know people are not applying it. So they're trying to spoon feed people, like a good teacher does, and they say, well, you're not thinking, look, I'll have to do your thinking for you. And if you don't apply it, how will you have any concept of whether you're obeying or not? if you're not listening to what is said? Are you building on firm ground at all? See, both Piper and MacArthur, I suppose the two most influential evangelicals in America, both insist Jesus spent a lot more time challenging those on sand than he did encouraging those who were on the rock. I don't know, perhaps you disagree with that. You know, I remember an excellent preacher in glory now. I remember him departing from his sermon. It was obvious. And he went off on this tangent. He was preaching, I think, on Agrippa in Acts 26. He went off on this tangent, and he was looking back at his long ministry and saying, I've spent 30-odd years chasing up half-saved, half-baked, half-committed church members who probably weren't saved at all. And I spent hours and hours and hours, and I wasted my time. Are you saved? No, he actually said, half the evangelicals in Wales are lost. Well, that's a massive thing to say, but was he right, though? See, if the foundations are wrong, it doesn't matter what the building looks like. It's hopeless, isn't it? It'll stand for a while, maybe for years. But sooner or later, the storms will, and storms will come, won't they? Storms of life. You know, 2 Thessalonians says that the day is coming when the Lord is going to shake everything. So that the only things that will remain are the things that can't be shaken, that are on the rock. You know, I remember in the early 90s going to a Banner of Truth conference, and a chap with a reputation for being very miserable and hard work to listen to, halfway through his address, he broke down. And he broke down as he was telling a story about Roman legion or something that had gone into battle, and with bad leadership, thousands of the soldiers had been slaughtered, and the centurion or whatever he was, or general, had to report back to Caesar then and explain what had gone wrong. And how Caesar had said to this man, and this is where the preacher broke down, give me back my soldiers. And the man just started crying, which was, it seemed to come out of nowhere in his address. And he as he was crying, he was saying, I think that's what God is saying to us. Give me back, where are the soldiers? Those who hear the command and just say, I don't think I'll bother. No. Those who say, is that what you're saying, Lord? Okay, give me back my soldiers, he was saying. Now, is that you? You know, why is it some people mature and they grow, and it's great, isn't it? You know, just think of Hugh Simon, he's not yours, using him as an illustration. You know, I remember after his first year, remember he came back after being here for a year and in Swansea for a year, and I remember talking to him just there and just saying, can I be honest, you wasted last year completely. And you know, he agreed. And I think, in a sense, it was a turning point, you know. Because if you admit, yes, I'm not taking any notice, I am not carrying on like this, I'm going to repent, I'm going to do something about it. Well, all things are possible now, aren't they? You know, Hebrews 5, just before we get to the scary bit in Hebrews 6, you know, solid food, says that whoever wrote it, is for the mature who by constant use have trained themselves to distinguish bad from good, best from, okay. See, we're commanded walk in the light. Every time you sin, you are deliberately saying, I'm going to step back into the dark. That's what sin is, isn't it? And we can't then, when people say, oh, well, you know, I've been living a terrible life or whatever, you can't get back into the light by overlooking your guilt. It is serious. I listened to a number of messages, they're on the internet, with the evangelical movement by Ian Parry on Hosea. They're very good, they're very long, but they're very good. But he makes the point, right at the end particularly, where Hosea makes a point of saying, now about all their guilt and so on, but he said, now when you go to God, you've got to take words with you. You've got to say, Lord, and you've got to say where you've sinned. Be honest with him, be upfront with him. Don't just say, well, I'm not getting anywhere and so on. Which we often do, or we just feel, oh, I feel a flop, I'm not getting anywhere, nothing's happening. You know, the day that we are like those who obey Hosea. If we all did it, this place would be transformed. It would. Our little fellowship here would be so changed. Now, thank God for the little flickers of light we've got. But if we all resolved and kept on resolving a desire and a determination to do what God says, what a change it would be. You know, maybe your quiet time has become a disaster. Maybe it has. Maybe it's become so much of a disaster you can't remember the last time you had one. You either say, oh, never mind, or something along that line. Or you say to yourself, this is serious. And then you say to the Lord, Lord, this is serious. I can't do it. Or maybe you're losing heart. Lord, I got no desire. Well, you could sing another song 24 times. That won't alter your desire. You know, we need God, don't we? We need God, and he's real. You know, there were all sorts of things. I had a bit of a disastrous day yesterday because of something. And I went to bed and my mind was going round and round, the same things all the time. And wonderfully, I actually said, Lord, there's no point in me just thinking about these things. You are up all night. There's no point in me lying here going over this. It does no good at all. Help me go to sleep. And I think I probably fell asleep there, and then I woke up at 6:30. Because, you know, pointed, he's on our side. Jonathan Edwards said, I have a view of my own vileness very frequently. How ignorant I was as a young Christian of the infinite depth of wickedness and pride and hypocrisy in my heart. He wasn't being morbid. He was being very honest. But God could do something with somebody like that. God can take hold of somebody who's not playing games. He was a man without guile, if you like. And, you know, he realized in saying that and saying it to God, he needed Jesus every second. Not just now and again. You know, there are people, they just want to get out of hell. Well, they're wise to want to get out of hell. But that's all they want, in a sense. They don't want to put Jesus first. There are dozens of things that are above Jesus in the pecking order of their lives. You know, before you obey anybody, you've got to be convinced it's worth it, haven't you? You know, if I was teaching or something, and you come into a classroom sometimes, because there was absolute chaos, and you'd assume there was no member of staff, and you'd run down the corridor and open the door to calm the kids down and realize there was a teacher there. And you think, right, well, the reason they're behaving like this is they're not taking any notice of what you're saying, because they don't think it's worth listening to what you're saying, because there's no clout. You've got no authority. Your words are meaningless. But if somebody else came in then, if the headmaster or you know, if somebody was good, somebody would come in, and they'd only have to stand there sometimes, instant silence. Why? Well, these people, they've got a respect. They might be terrified, but they've got some kind of respect here. They're going to listen if the person, you know, some teachers, all they had to do was, that was it. The person, why? They listen to them. You know, Bob Dylan in the 70s, professed faith. I know he threw it all away. But he wrote the song, you may serve the devil or you may serve the Lord, but you're going to serve somebody. Well, he was spot on, wasn't he? We all serve somebody. You can say, I do my own thing, which is 1 John 3, lawlessness, sin is lawlessness. I do my own thing is lawlessness. I do my thing, not you as Lord. I do my own thing. Putting my wants, my felt needs, whatever it is, up the top, and whatever Jesus says down the bottom. You know, to do my own thing and yet still be in church and singing the songs and reading the Bible and praying or whatever is like a husband who never goes out drinking but beats his wife up every night. you know, it's I'm not guilty of that, but I'm guilty of this. You know, we come to the old Puritans used to say, I know they're quaint, and I know some of them were legalistic, but they used to say, we come to church for our marching orders. Now, do you come to hear his voice? Do you come to, I suppose it'd be fascinating, it'd probably be painful to ask people honestly why they come. But do you come to hear the voice of God? Or do you come to hear, good, people go to conferences, they hear and they say, oh, that was good, that was 8, oh, I'd say give them 8 out of 10. That was not so good, that's a 7. Or do we come to hear the voice of God, to hear his voice? Otherwise, where do we know, how do we know what to do, where to go? Or do we just listen to the nice things and anything is unpleasant? Oh, I don't believe that. I was reminded last week that some years ago some scientists were looking into space and they looked for 10 to the power of 24 miles. A million, 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 million miles. I mean, already my mind is gone. Like, this is just, And they looked and they said, now they weren't Christians, but they looked and they said, in the 10 to the power of 24 miles we've looked, there's only life here. I was just thinking, 10 to the power of 24 miles, all that, he saved me. Do you know? In all that, not only does he save me, knows your name if you're his. Some years ago, in the house that my daughter lives in now, I decided to, there was rough walls of old stonework. I decided I would put wall boards on them. And they looked all right. Even if I did them, they looked all right. But pretty soon they all started buckling, and I realized that, although they looked all right for a while, once we took them off, behind was just mold, just all sorts of stuff growing. But it looked all right, see, for a year or so. And Sid's house is on sand, and it looks okay. Now, that couldn't possibly be you, could it? Could you be building on sand? Could you really be building on sand? In Malachi, when Malachi says to them, this is what God says, you're robbing me. They say, how? They can't believe that he's talking to them. How could they be guilty of that? Do you remember, or some of you were old enough to remember, 1987, Michael Fish was giving the weather forecast on BBC, and he said, a lady's just run up. She says, there's a hurricane coming. Well, there isn't, but there was. And poor old Michael Fish took stick for years after it. But what? And 20 people got killed. But I remember reading that there were places where, there were 20 trees, say, all growing together. And what happened was that, say, 19 of them had no root at all. They were held up by this one. And if the one was caught in the wind, they all went over. I remember thinking, that's it, isn't it? That's it. We can be held up by each other in church, can we? We can fool each other easily. Has Christ got you by the roots? Colossians, rooted and grounded in Christ. Is that you, though? You know the story of the lady in John Newton's church who was on her deathbed, and he visited. Now, John Newton was a great preacher and a godly pastor, but she said to him, Pastor, you told me lots about Jesus. You should have warned me more. And I've never forgotten those words. I don't want you to be on the deathbed and you panicking. Especially I don't want you panicking because I have neglected to warn you that unless you are on the rock doing what he says, there's the proof. I read a great story last week of a fellow, William Callahan, many years ago now. He was a career criminal in America, and he was arrested. He was bound up in prison or whatever. And then some years later, he came out. And when he was in middle age, he was converted to Christ. And he knew he'd been saved. And he was passionately sharing his testimony. And after a few years of this, you know, his name got known. And so he got in touch with the police and he said, look now, you know, I've been clean for all these years. You know my life has changed. Can I have my record erased? And can I have all pictures of me returned? And they said, yeah. They were convinced this man's changed. But years, he carried on for years and years and years, and he realized that all the police had given him all the stuff back, the prison hadn't. He was still on the prison record, and his photo, you know, when they take a photo of you going in, was there. Now, he hadn't committed a crime for like 40 years. He was a godly man, and he was giving his testimony somewhere, and the governor of Illinois was there, a chap called Atgeld. And he heard this guy's testimony, and he heard in the testimony the guy say, I just would want, before I die, to have this record erased, and so there's nothing. And the governor said, I'll do whatever I can. I'm going to try and get this for you. And he did. And as he gave it to William Callahan, he said, here's the photos, here's the record. Now the only record is in your mind. And, you know, to know that is dealt with, that we've been dealt with. My sin has been dealt with. Oh, yeah, I know I leave a trail, but it's been dealt with. Or, you know, this awful story here, verse 27, you know, the rains come and so on, the fellow who doesn't build on the rock, and in the version I've got, great was its fall. I think in the version that was on the screen, came down with a crash. Crashing down. The echo from a collapsed soul echoing through eternity. All that they'd heard, all that you've heard. You know, when we were in Aberystwyth, we went to a playground as we went under the road, there's this underpass. And if you shout, you know, it echoes. It's, you know, the kids love it and they're making a noise and it echoes and echoes. But imagine something that just kept echoing and echoing, and it was a horrible noise. It just kept echoing. And echoing, reverberating for eternity. There's no salvation for knowing things about Jesus. There's no salvation for understanding the cross. The only proof that you were saved is that you obey. Now, you don't obey to be saved, but if you are saved, it must show in fruit, because this is what you were saved for. He saved you to live a new life, a different life. We heard it from Simon this morning. Living a new life. You know, in the world, you know, people, they serve to get somewhere, to be successful. But in the Christian life, service is success. In the world, people serve to be great. Try and climb up the ladder in their company or whatever, or a celebrity. But in the Christian life, service is greatness. There is no greater thing than to serve God. To serve God. You know, and to know where your gifts and talents are so that you can use them for Him, for His fame, for His glory. You know, I'm reading through Exodus, and we come to chapter 5. I'm nearly finished. Where Moses and Aaron eventually pluck up the courage to go to Pharaoh and say, look, the Lord says, let my people go. And Pharaoh says, who is this Lord? Who is the Lord that I should obey Him? Now, that's what an unbeliever says, isn't it? Who is this God? But, of course, the next chapter, Moses is saying to God, Lord, the Israelites are not listening to me. Why would Pharaoh? Are you listening? Are you obeying? Again, to a close with Hosea, take words with you. Take words with you. He says, for a start, we're hoping to be on the square, go into all the world. You're going? You're going into the world where you are? was listening to Piper last week, and he said that his aim in this conference, he's an English graduate, he uses lots of words, was that people would have a radical revelation of the cross that would obliterate their inadequacies. Well, put simply, it's this, isn't it? If you see, O infinite Redeemer, I bring no other plea, because thou dost invite me, I cast myself. Yes.